Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, May 16th, 2025, and our friends Colonel Wilkerson and Larry Johnson are back with us. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Larry, let's start with you and what has happened in the Middle East. The Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia, then Qatar, and he's talking about a proposal to Iranians. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, Trump continues to try to play both sides. On the plane today, he said that the United States is placed like its final offer before Iran, and Iran better take it or else there'll be bad things. You know, I think that's just his negotiating posture. Iran, I don't think, is going to be bullied into an agreement. Iran has agreed, as I had anticipated, that, you know, they'll limit their enrichment to 3.6%. Everything above that will be done outside the country. They will allow on-site inspectors, and, you know, that nothing else, that they're not going to have to start eliminating missiles and vow never to talk to Hamas, Hezbollah, or the Houthis. Whether Trump will accept that, I think, is still an open question. He'd be wise to do it. But if he refuses to do it, then he's backed himself into a corner where he has intimated that he'll take military action. Well, you know, given the rousing success of the United States in crushing the Houthis, that'd be pretty stupid of him to do, because Iran is in a much stronger position than the Houthis ever were in terms of being able to repel such attacks. So, you know, Trump's trying to pretend that the ball is in Iran's court. It's not really. It's in Trump's court. What is he going to do? Will he take the deal that's on the table, or will he walk away from it?
Larry, your take.
D'accord avec mon ami Larry.
Yeah. Yeah, you mean Colonel Wilkerson. You want Colonel Wilkerson, right?
Yeah, I would.
Colonel,
yeah. Yeah, we got to keep it straight.
I'm going to keep it Colonel Wilkerson.
Yeah, we got to take
up a title for Larry.
Yeah.
Intelligence guru Larry.
Colonel, it seems that something happening with his internet connection.
Oh, did it go down on him?
Colonel, again?
Can you hear us?
Yeah,
I can hear you. You're back. Go ahead, Colonel.
Listening to John this morning, Mearsheimer, I heard him phrase an explanation of Trump that was priceless. And I think it applies here. I think it applies with everything Trump does, as a matter of fact. And that is, he recognizes now, how much is around a president of the United States, no matter what he wants. It's coming from every angle, neoconservative, radical, whatever you want to call people around him. Now, he blessed himself, cursed himself to a certain extent, with the cabinet he selected, as does the president. But Mearsheimer then went on to say that when Trump keeps it in his head and only pontificates occasionally, maybe he's pontificating for various reasons amongst this group of people he knows positively oppose this or that aspect of what he's trying to do. And so he uses this technique to say things that sometimes are genuine, that he knows are going to rile the people around him from Rubio to Hegseth, and then reverses himself when he gets into a position where he can really ram it.
Oh, yeah, his connection froze again.
Yeah.
But I think that's back. True. I think that's true, and I think you have to... you have to parse what Trump says with that kind of understanding of why he's saying it and who's opposing him on any particular issue. And this is not just his cabinet or his cabinet equivalent people, special envoys and so forth. It's also the other leaders, like Stalin, for example, who sent his disciple with Zelensky on bull. And everybody knows what this disciple is supposed to do. Zelensky and Zelensky execute Stalin wishes with him, which are to continue the conflict as long as possible. So I think Trump is ill-served, saying, and I think John's right about that. But Trump is aware of that, and so you have to really parse his remarks with regard to knowing he understands that, trying to figure out who he's saying it against or for, and what his really true motivations are, which I'm not even sure he knows from time to time. That makes it really difficult.
Carl, can you do something with your internet connection? Because you are just freezing up frequently, yeah.
Larry, let me come on. I'll come back on again.
Okay. Larry, when it comes to the point that Colonel was trying to raise, that the main objectives in the mind of Donald Trump and what does he want really from the Middle East, what would come to your mind? What is the picture that comes to your mind?
Well, I think he's still holding on to the hopes of making the Abraham Accords become a reality. Now, Steve Witkoff is out today saying he's got a whole host of, you know, list of Azerbaijan, Armenia, all are willing to sign on to the Abraham Accords. Well, the essence of the Abraham Accords is to recognize the state of Israel and its right to exist. And he even said, oh, yeah, the Saudis are on board with this. Well, I doubt that that is the case. They're not willing to do it uncritically. I think they've told Trump, yeah, we'll recognize Israel's right to exist once it stops murdering the Palestinians and agrees to a Palestinian state. So that's where Trump's trying to get. So he's going to line up all these countries who are, let's say, inclined to support the Abraham Accords, provided that the genocide stops and the Palestinians have a state. So that means Trump's got the task of not persuading the Israelis, telling them how it's going to be. And I think the Israelis, the Zionist crowd, are particularly nervous these days because of the warmth that was showered on Trump. They recognize that Trump's a sucker for flattery, and boy, Mohammed bin Salman and the Sheikh and Qatar, and then the Emiratis, boy, they were really polishing Trump's rear end, and he loved it, but really. Because deep down he's a pretty insecure person. Despite all of his success and all of his wealth, he still it bugs him that he didn't get the kind of respect he think he ought to get. So Trump is I think he hopes to pull the Abraham Accords out as his legacy. But to do that, I don't see any of the Arab, the Gulf states backing away from their demands regarding a Palestinian state and the end of the genocide by the Zionists.
Colonel, what Larry said, resuming what he said, that he believes that the main objectives on the part of Donald Trump is the Abraham Accord. But the problem with that accord is the Saudi Arabia and Arab states are not the way that they were before. And right now they're asking for a Palestinian state, which is not, we don't know how much pressure Donald Trump is receiving from the Israeli government in that term.
I think Trump is perfectly willing to go ahead with the Abraham Accords minus Israel. And that's the hammer he will hold over Netanyahu's head. If Netanyahu doesn't respond, I don't think Netanyahu's long for the world right now. The subsequent leader will. So that's a good tactic.
And when it comes to, Colonel, you didn't mention the case of Iran. And Larry said that Iran is prepared to make a deal with Donald Trump. But the The question is on the part of the United States, on the part of the Trump administration. Are they prepared to do that, in your opinion?
I think Trump is. As I was saying before, when my net went down, I think Mearsheimer's right about interpreting Trump in this particular instance, very right, that Trump knows he has a lot of enemies. One of them is in Turkey right now. His name is Lindsey Graham, and he's with his Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, of all things. And he knows these enemies are going to try to derail everything he's trying to do and subsequently might succeed in the Congress with Lindsey Graham leading the fight. So he's got to be very careful about what he says. He's got to sneak up on it, I think. And he's got to lay these things out all along that appease these other people for temporary purposes. But once it's done, I think he thinks he can drive it home. So I think we're seeing a convoluted, if you will, talking pattern around Trump, added to by these advisors who are trying to do things to disturb it too. But I think the talks are going okay.
Larry, when it comes to Donald Trump's attitude, we know that he's so much considering the deal between how does the United States benefit from any sort of relationship. If we consider that sort of attitude on his part, do you think that it could bring some sort of change in this, in the way that the United States sees the Middle East? Because let's assume Donald Trump look at Israel. He has to pay Israel for everything. And he goes to Saudi Arabia, to Qatar. He receives instead of paying, he receives. And in the case of Iran, I would argue if something happens between Iran and the United States, something good happened between Iran and the United States, it would be beneficial for both parties. But with the continuous conflict in the Middle East, the United States has to pay more and more to Israel.
Well, yeah. I mean, Israel's a lost leader. You know, it's like having that relative move in with you that eats all your food, drives your car, and wrecks your house. You know, that's Israel. There may be a, you know, close to us as historically, but good God, they're a curse, a plague. So, you know, the Gulf Arabs, you know, and I give Mohammed bin Salman credit, you know, they understand, throw $1 trillion at Donald Trump and boy, he'll jump around like, you know, the organ grinder monkey. He will dance and do whatever you need to do. And they knew exactly how to play him. And, you know, I think Trump's happy to be played that way. During the speech, when, you know, Trump made that, said, hey, I'm going to lift sanctions on Syria. Boy, the crowd went wild. They're applauding, you know, like seals getting ready to get fed. And then when he mentioned something about, and I'm going to look forward to bringing you into the Abraham Accord, dead silence. You know, it's like being in a mausoleum at that point. So, you know, this all this happy talk has been, oh, yeah, man, these guys are lined up for the Abraham Accord. You know, I think Trump wants that deal, but he's going to have to rein in Israel ultimately, you know, bring him to heel. And, you know, the reports out of the Middle East Spectator last night, I don't know if it's confirmed, was that the Israelis, they waited until Trump was leaving the Middle East to start renew their offensive in Gaza. And again, it's sort of a fool's mission for them because, you know, they couldn't accomplish it in the previous 20 months. All they're keen on is killing Palestinians. And yet it's finally, I think, the international level of outrage has risen across the board. You know, we saw China 2 days ago before the International Court of Justice just really lambasting the Netanyahu and crowd. So, you know, maybe the worm's starting to turn on this, but Israel's showing no signs of coming to its senses, and it's up to Donald Trump to see if he can knock it into him.
Larry, do you?
How Larry you or see? Larry or Colonel Wilkerson?
Yeah, Colonel. Yeah, again. Colonel, do you see that this visit shows somehow some sort of unity within the Arab states? among the Arab states. Do you see that, or that's not the case anymore? That we cannot argue that.
I think it's always difficult to attribute, if we're talking about 22 countries, any kind of unity to the Arab states, other than the fact that they have a league. But I do think, well, let me back up just a moment. You know, I listened again this morning to Trump's more startling remarks in some regards. Now, I know he didn't write that speech. I'd really like to know who wrote that speech for him. He didn't even know how to pronounce Kabul, or Kabul, as most people say. I think most people in the region call it Kabul. Kabul. I'm not even sure he could point to Kabul on a map. He did know how to say Baghdad. He's, after all, had more experience there. But what he said in that speech was a complete repudiation of all American foreign policy, diminished a bit by President Obama, back to the end of H.W. Bush's administration. A total repudiation of the neoconservatives, a total repudiation of weaponizing liberal democracy in the name of power and hegemony, a total repudiation of many of the people who are arrayed around Trump right now, trying their best to derail what he wants to do, that you and I would probably think was fairly positive. So this was a remarkable set of remarks in a place that, you know, was not really the place to deliver them, but he did. I'm sure the Arabs had no, most of them anyway, even bin Salman and bin Zayed too, probably didn't even understand the full context of what he was saying with regard to American foreign policy gone badly astray for the past 20 plus years. So I'm waiting to see just what comes out of that in terms of defeating, if you will, the neoconservatives within its midst and within the country in general. Second, I would say I do think that Netanyahu is perched right now, ready to fall. This sustained military operation is opposed by almost all of his sane military leaders. It's opposed by the rank and file to a certain extent, too, particularly the reservists. And what it is he's starting the very same thing we did with the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. He's starting an operation that will be more beneficial to the insurgents, as it were, than to the established military. And they know that. Not only that, but they have made the terrain absolutely perfect for this kind of insurgency by rubbling it, by destroying it. Now the benefit goes to the guerrillas. Now the benefit goes to those who opposed us in Iraq and really defeated us in Iraq. So it's going to get worse and worse and worse on the battlefield, which is a place the Israelis are not accustomed to having things like that turn sour on them. So I think, as I said before, I think Netanyahu's days are numbered. And when he goes, I think Trump is astute enough to leap into that gap between whoever, you know, replaces him and Netanyahu's departure and whatever brouhaha occurred. They'll probably do like they did with Sharon. You know, they're going to put Sharon in jail. And he had cancer, I think it was, really badly. So they excused him from that. And he died very shortly thereafter. I wouldn't put Netanyahu's life longevity very long either. But I think we're looking at an entirely different situation, perhaps developing in the Middle East, thank God. And it's going to be based in part, at least, on the fact that Israel's going to be defeated.
Larry, do you see Arab states united in the case of having a Palestinian state?
on the lip service level, yes. But, you know, the action level, no. You know, they talk a good game so far, but they're not really, the only country that's backing it up with action have been the Houthis. Yeah. And, you know, they're an amazing, remarkable people. They've got every disadvantage against them, and yet they're not backing down. And hey, they put a notch in their belt, like, you know, the Sioux Indians in the United States, counting coup. They got some U.S. scalps on their belt. You know, they stood up to the U.S. Navy and stared it down. Now, Jordan and Egypt, you know, they've got, you know, they have the most direct interest to be of being border, you know, bordering Israel and facing the potential of those Palestinians coming into their country. They don't want that. But they've not been, you know, publicly demanding anything that I've seen. And so, you know, the only thing that I guess Israel, if they continue to, if they try to go back in and start slaughtering, on apart from slaughtering the Palestinians, continuing the starvation program, then you know, I think the level of outrage in the Arab world is growing. So, you know, I share Colonel Wilkerson's hopes that we may be entering a new phase, a new era, but you know, unfortunately, there's going to be still a lot of Palestinians dying, especially you know the women and children from the malnutrition. I mean, this is it's turned into a charnel house, and it's horrific. And that the Israelis, you know, these Zionists who do this, do it with, you know, they're frankly they're behaving just like the Nazi SS did when they went in and cleaned out ghettos in Poland.
If you saw Nima, if you saw the you probably saw the UN secretary, UN undersecretary, I think, for humanitarian affairs. He was really graphic yesterday, day before yesterday, actually, at the United Nations. And then there was an interview with a very good reporter. I think she was from Sky, who played him and then had the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations on. And you could have said that was a Nazi. You could have said it was Gerhard. It was, you know, one of the most despicable SS Nazis of all. I mean, his responses to that man's clear presentation of the atrocities in Israel that were happening, especially the starvation, and then his answers were a composite of what's happening right now. And I think it also illustrated how, and that reporter's questions, which were just piercing, she'd done her homework, were an indication of how things are shifting. Things are changing with regard to the view of Israel.
Yeah.
And I think they're changing in America too.
And nobody, Larry, can deny that this time, this visit of Donald Trump was totally different from the visit he had in his first term. And he went to Middle East, Israel, and all of that, and tried to make some sort of agreement between Israel and the Arab states. Right now, it's the face of the Middle East has totally changed. And if we assume, if we give the benefit of even talking about, because the way that Donald Trump is talking about Iran, he says we can change everything. It's going to be a new era of, I don't know, the relationship between the United States and Iran. Do you find any sort of reality? Do you see any sort of reality in that sort of talk in the way that he's talking about it?
Not yet, particularly with respect to Iran. the failure to accurately describe both Iran's current role and to understand where it was 10 years ago. You know, because right now they like to present Iran, oh, boy, they're weak, they're desperate, you know. No, they're not. Iran is in a much stronger position today than it was 10 years ago. I mean, 10 years ago, the Chinese and Russians were willing to line up and put sanctions on it. Now, Iran's got a comprehensive security agreement signed with Russia, and they have some other arrangements with the Chinese. At a minimum, every year, China and Russia are conducting joint military exercises with Iran. You know, so that's number one. Number two, Iran, by joining BRICS, is looking to leave the Western financial system and will find an alternative. The other thing, though, is, you know, in Trump world, Iran is represented as this malicious, malevolent force for terrorism in the region. This is mighty terrorist nation. The reality, and like I deal with facts. So I went back and looked at the country reports on terrorism published by the U.S. State Department. All that data is collected by the office, the National Counterterrorism Center, NCTC. And it's based on U.S. intelligence. Except for 2023 and the preceding years, there is not a single country that is receiving money or support from Iran that's listed as a major terrorist group. The top 10 terrorist groups are all funded by the Saudis and the other Gulf Arabs. And, you know, here's Trump, shaking hands and doing an embrace with al-Shara, formerly known as al-Jalani, who was a member of ISIS, and then al-Nusra and Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. They were listed from 2017 forward as the number seven most active terrorist group in the world. And yet, what was Iran's response to the rise of this radical Sunni Salafist extremism in Syria? Iran sent its military forces to fight it. The same thing that we were claiming we were ostensibly doing. So in that sense, here was Iran really on our side, and yet we refused to recognize it or acknowledge it. And so we've created this cartoon of Iran as this irredeemable sponsor of terrorism. Absolutely not true. Absolutely not true. And, you know, we can go, yeah, do they support Hamas? Sure. And I can show you the Israeli government's foreign ministry of figures from August 2000 through April 2024, a grand total that they identified of 672 Palestinian terrorist incidents, and of those, only 105 were carried out by Hamas over a 20-year period. That's not a terrorist tsunami. So, you know, this refusal to deal with facts drives me crazy. But, you know, and I think that's where Iran is in a much more confident position now, with the backing of Russia and China, that it's going to, you know, and militarily, they've shown that they can hit Israel if they want to. And Israel can't stop him.
Colonel al-Jolani, and he went to Saudi Arabia. He talked with Donald Trump. And we know that Donald Trump has announced that he's going to lift all the sanctions in Syria. How do you find Donald Trump and the way that he's dealing with al-Jolani? Do you think that would be the foreign policy of the United States for the coming years, or is just a tactic for the moment?
I think almost anything the empire does now is a tactic for the moment, with one or two exceptions, because the empire doesn't know what it's doing. It doesn't know how to deal with what's happening, which is, as I've told you before, a humongous shift of power from the West toward the East, with China being the magnet sucking that power. And we're trying our best in every way, fashion, or form to contest that, most prominently with using Ukraine as a proxy to fight one of the elements of that shift. A huge element of that shift now, we have made it that. It wasn't before, but now it is. Russia has made the decision now. Always positioned in that heartland that, you know, Mackinder talked about, and that do I go east or do I go west? Do I go east or do I go west? Well, Russia, we forced Russia to make that decision now. Russia has made a decision to join that group, of which the BRICS are a manifestation, if you will. And Iran's in that group, and India's in that group, and Pakistan's in that group. And what is it? 4/5 of the world's population is in that group. So this is very difficult for the empire to deal with. So we kind of make it up as we go along. And Trump's administration is a make it up as you go along administration anyway, for the reasons that I've outlined. They have so many different outliers within the administration, some of whom he's brought in purposefully. So it's very difficult to say where we're going at any given time on any given issue, no matter how fundamental it might be. Ukraine stands out. Gaza stands out. Iran stands out. As Larry has said, clearly, Iran is not an enemy of the United States of America, prima facie. It is not. And it is not an enemy in terms of its capability to do things that would be very harmful to our interests, even in the region. Now, I can't say that for Israel. I can't say that for Israel for a minute. Israel is the worst ally, if you can even bless them with the name of ally, this country's ever had in its history. They are not an ally. They're a liability. They're a strategic, a fundamental liability. And I hope what Trump has just done leads to that changing. I don't have great aspirations for it, but I hope it leads to at least a better relationship in terms of the other people in the region. And the other thing I think Trump was saying was something that he said all along. And I'm going to be watching this really closely, and the place where he was is a real indicator of how he did. Are we going to leave? Are we going to get our presence off the ground there, or are we going to stay there? And with regard to Syria, I understand he has countermanded his order about getting the U.S. forces out of Syria, which I was grateful to hear, because they're sitting in the middle of a silica mine. And that silica mine is very, very valuable in terms of these critical minerals and everything that people want in the world now, including us. And so we're going to stay there. Are we there to guard that mine, to keep that mine safe for us? What are we there for? And the last thing I'll say about his relationship with the new leader of Syria, as it were, is FDR had to deal with Stalin. I mean, you got to deal with people sometimes. And in this particular instance, it's probably a wise decision to lift the sanctions and deal with this guy. I don't care if he's killed Americans in the past. Well, maybe I do, but you got to deal with people as they come and as they evolve and as they metamorphose. And this guy seems to have made quite a metamorphosis, if it's legitimate. At any rate, he's got the people of Syria. I thought yesterday I saw 500,000 Syrians are now back and in their homes or near their homes and feeling pretty good about the state of their country. That's a hell of an achievement. So God bless Trump for doing that.
You know, it's not without precedent, the United States embracing terrorists who become leaders of countries. There was this fellow named Menachem Begin, and then there was Yitzhak Shamir. I mean, Begin, I think, was Irgun.
Durian.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's not without precedent.
I don't know how to deal with these contradicts of Donald Trump. And he, on one hand, he wants to withdraw from Europe, and he says he wants to somehow withdraw from Syria, but he said that he's somehow disappointed with the way that they withdrew from Afghanistan. They would prefer to have forces in Afghanistan. How do you evaluate that, Larry?
Well, I think what Trump was referencing with respect to Afghanistan was there was a right way and a wrong way to pull out. You know, we could have, instead of state of Bagram, instead of, you know, immediately they closed down Bagram, turned it over, and so they cut off their secure means of getting in and out of the country and being able to resupply. Bagram is a much easier facility to defend than, you know, the airport right there in the middle of Kabul. So, you know, I think Trump is proposing something a little more thoughtful. At least I would hope so.
Yeah,
I would just add to that, from a military professional's point of view, I would have stayed in Afghanistan, and I would have stayed there in a very different fashion than we were positioned to stay at the time we exited, or that we were more or less creating during the entire time we were there, which is 1 year at a time, just 1 year at a time. We never had a strategy. We never had a philosophy even. But my reason for staying in Afghanistan would have been several key things. One, it puts us in Central Asia, okay? Southwest Asia, Central Asia, the tip of Central Asia. Two, it puts us next to probably one of the most dangerous nuclear stockpiles in the world in Pakistan. And three, and this is going to sound really underhanded, but I'm sometimes that way too, it puts the CIA in a place where they could use the Uyghurs to significantly destabilize China were we to have to go to war with China. I wouldn't want that to come to fruition, and neither any more than I'd want a war with China to come to fruition. But it looks in many ways like Mearsheimer's right. We are inevitably going to get in a conflict with China sooner or later, probably sooner rather than later, because we're going to be so bad later, we won't be able to handle it. I'm not sure we can handle it now. So Afghanistan put us in a region of the world that is very significant, ask the British, ask the Russians. And we were there. We didn't have to stay there and build a nation. We didn't have to stay there and, you know, export liberal democracy. We just stay there and treat the government that existed really well and have a presence in a region that is far more important, in my view, militarily, to have a presence than, say, down in Kuwait or other places we are in Southwest Asia.
Yeah. Larry, do you see that the case of Iran for Donald Trump is much easier? You remember we talked about it various times, and you said that the case of Ukraine is much easier for Donald Trump to put an end to it. Right now, how do you see the two conflicts, the case of Iran and Ukraine?
The biggest problem Trump has with respect to Iran is his the neoconservative base that's still part of his party. If you've watched the vitriol coming from Mark Levin and Ben Shapiro directed at Steve Witkoff, yeah. I mean, Witkoff's a Jew. Shapiro's a Jew. Levin's a Jew. But according to Levin and Shapiro, Witkoff's not a good Jew. No. In fact, he's an anti-Semitic Jew. I mean, it's just like, are you
self-loathing Jew.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, they're out of their minds. They can't believe that Trump would even entertain this. And so that's the biggest problem that Trump faces right now, is that if to proceed with a deal that will be palatable, acceptable to Iran, it's going to enrage this ultra-Zionist component, you know, it's represented by people like Mike Huckabee. But, you know, Trump may be willing to do that because Ryan Dawson, I don't know if you know who he is, but Ryan reminded me the other day that Witkoff is very, very close with the wealthiest Israeli in the country, who is a real estate guy as well in New York City. And that guy is not friends with Netanyahu at all. And that guy has been friends with Trump as well. So Trump sort of has, you know, these personal relationships with a segment of Israeli society that are not necessarily, well, that are opposed to Netanyahu. So he may be able, you know, he may still be able to go forward with that deal because, you know, Witkoff's the one that's cutting it. It will collapse if the United States insists that Iran must eliminate all nuclear enrichment and must take down its missiles and must cut off all contact with Hamas, Hezbollah, and then the Houthis, then it's dead. And Trump will, you know, there goes his Nobel Peace Prize. But if he does go with the deal with Iran, Iran's more than ready, you know, because the real stumbling block is the inspection, and Iran's already said, come on in. You notice the desperation of these Zionists when they concocted this nonsense last week that, oh my God, we just discovered a secret, top secret. Man, this is the ultra top secret nuclear facility in Iran, and nobody knew about it until now. And in the corner, the source of it was this Iranian opposition group. I'm going, oh, gee, I bet they've never gotten a single dime from the CIA. You know, a bunch of independent entrepreneurs out there. I mean, this was just, this thing was so ham-handedly handed to the media that, the credibility of it was immediately called into question. But that's an example of the pushback that's coming.
And just to reinforce what Larry said, this is about the third or fourth time that this group has done this sort of thing.
Yeah.
John Bolton is a big party with this group. He gets $40,000 speaking fees from them.
Colonel, can we say that Donald Trump has never been in a better position to deal with Netanyahu as he is right now?
I think you can say that. And Netanyahu is mostly responsible for that. But Trump has some of the, let's put it this way. He's the one who decided not to stop in Jerusalem on his way, you know, home. That's a blow. That's a blow, because one of Netanyahu's most powerful tools is when I crook my arm, the American president comes. And that's the reason he comes to Washington so often, to prove to his own citizens that he controls the sugar daddy, that he has the sugar daddy in his back pocket. Well, mm-hmm. Trump just rebuffed that.
Yeah. Larry, Netanyahu is not just facing the conflict outside of Israel, and with the case of, as you've mentioned, with the case of Gaza, he wants to attack Gaza. He, as we talk, they're attacking, they're somehow responding to Yemen. And how about inside Israel? Do you see that people in Israel are getting closer to somehow say to Netanyahu, you're not anymore the prime minister, you're not that much beneficial to Israel?
What you're seeing is the fracturing of Israel into three camps. Let's call it the settler camp, the Ben-Gavirs, the Smotrich. They appear to be the largest, not necessarily a majority, but the largest plurality. Then you've got sort of the, let's call it the traditional European, the Golda Meir crowd. That doesn't mean that those two sides, they share something in common. It's a hatred of the Palestinians by and large and a desire to destroy them. So I don't want to present that, oh, there's one crowd that wants to work with the Palestinians. No, they are diametrically opposed. And then you've got the ultra-Orthodox, the ones who are refusing to serve in the military and who do not recognize Israel as a fulfillment of prophecy. They think it is actually an abomination. The voices within, let's call it the European crowd, the Ashkenazi, have grown more strident, more aggressive, and a number of generals are speaking out. The attack on the head of Shin Bet by Netanyahu has elicited a great pushback. You've then got the military fatigue that's setting in among the reservists, because Israel is largely a reserve army. And, you know, I remember my boss at State Department was a retired Marine 06, Dominic Richard Aloysius Gannon. And at the very start of the first Gulf War, he says, yeah, now we're going to see why everybody thinks the Israelis are so great. And I said, well, why is that, Colonel? He said, they've only fought Arabs. And he was very disdainful of the Israeli army's military capability. And he said, look, they don't have this NCO corps that a modern, you know, like the U.S. military does. And, you know, where you have senior sergeants, staff sergeants, first sergeants, that guys that have enlisted but have risen through the ranks, got experience, because inevitably these are the guys that mentor, you know, newly minted lieutenants and young captains. They keep them from doing stupid stuff, which all officers like that are prone to do. Israel doesn't have that. So you look at the Israeli army right now. You've got, you know, Private Shmuckatella at he's 19 with a Captain Shlomo who's 20. Well, there's no way in hell you could be an effective officer at the age of 20, not having had time to be seasoned with experience. So what's happening within the Israeli military ranks is increasing signs of battle fatigue, post-traumatic stress disorder. They're running into the same thing that the German Wehrmacht did when they first went into Poland and then Ukraine in World War II, where they were lining civilians up and shooting them and putting them into pits. That the regular army, the regular German army, suffered severe psychological, emotional crisis over that. And there are documents from their field commanders writing back up the chain of command to Berlin saying, hey, you got to stop this. You're ruining the combat effectiveness of our troops. Israel's running into the same thing. They're not all a bunch of predatory thugs or maniacs. You've got a number of decent human beings who are put into this horror, and they're psychologically breaking down. The rate of suicide for the size of that army has been going up.
Carl, your take on Israeli army?
Well, I just reinforce what Larry said. I remember it's probably been destroyed now by Israel, but there was a video of Moshe Dayan, and I remember it vividly. He was being chased by a reporter who was asking him after the Six-Day War, the Blitzkrieg War, how'd you do it? How'd you do it? How'd you do it? And he finally turned on the reporter and he said, well, it helps to be fighting Arabs in English.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
I think Larry's right. I think they're having trouble, and not just for the reasons Larry outlined, but also because for the past 20 years, those who are regulars, more or less, and some reservists have been on garrison duty, where they could butt stroke the Palestinian who wasn't cooperating at the checkpoint and did so all the time, maybe even shoot them in the knee or the foot or something. I mean, these kind of incidents occurred every day. It's not like it started on October the 7th. Been going on for quite a while, especially with Netanyahu in charge. They're not the most fabulous army in the world. They're not the army that everyone in Israel wants all their enemies to think they are. And now right. They've been deteriorated majorly. They've been really disturbed. And throwing these Orthodox who have responded to the draft call in is not going to help at all.
Larry, what has happened in Istanbul? The two delegations have met. Somehow they're talking about there was no outcome, no positive outcome. Some say that it was positive. Yeah. How did you find the talks between the two delegations?
Well, a lot of it's show, because the war is not really between Russia and Ukraine. The war is between Russia and NATO. Ukraine is just a pawn in this. And it's not a matter... We need to dispense with this idea that, oh, if we just get Russia and Ukraine to sit down together and work out their differences. That's the root cause of this is NATO's expansion to the east, NATO's arming, equipping of Ukraine, and preparing it to have been an army that would defeat Russia. NATO's plan to provoke a confrontation with Russia in order, because NATO foolishly believed they could defeat Russia. And this project's been underway since at least 1995. Yeah, it really got going in 1997, and Clinton kicked it off in 1999 with the expansion of NATO, adding three more countries, expanding NATO at a time when the Russian army is contracting and shrinking. Makes absolutely no sense. Yeah. There's no justification whatsoever. So, apparently what's reported is that the one thing they did agree on, they're going to exchange prisoners at 1,000 for 1,000. That's a great deal for Russia because Russia's got a lot more, has far fewer soldiers that are in Ukrainian custody than Russia's holding in its custody. But Russia's basic point was, look, here's our starting negotiating position. You withdraw from Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, Luhansk, and then we can talk about a ceasefire. And reportedly, Medinsky said, and if you don't do that, we're going to take Dnipropetrovsk and Sumy as buffer regions, and we'll keep going. So, the ball's definitely in Ukraine's camp to figure out how to respond. Now they're going to reject that. There's no specific date set for new talks. They're trying. There's a lot of spin putting out that at least they met. Yeah, that's great. But until NATO decides to say, okay, we're done. We're no longer going to attack Russia. Because notice what's happened in this last week, in the last 4 days. I believe it was on Monday. The Germans, And the Danes, they tried to take on a tanker, and to you know, seize it. One of the ghost ships of Russia. Russia had a corvette, which is a small naval vessel, but one capable of firing missiles. But the Boyki, it intervened, drove off the Germans and the Danes. And then 2 days ago, the Estonians, with the backing apparently of the Poles, they tried to hijack another Russian ship bound for Russia, and the ship's captain politely told the Estonians to go have sex with their mother. I think it was a much cruder expression, but then they got on the horn to the port in Russia, and the Russians dispatched an SU 35, 37. I'm not up to speed on all the combat aircraft that the Russians have, but it came because up to that point the ship was being circled by a Polish jet, a MiG, and a helicopter and a fixed wing ISR aircraft. And when the Russian showed up on scene, he was basically targeting these guys, and they all fled. So that level of confront, that's going to continue. I think that's going to be actually where the war kicks off initially. It's going to happen out of the Baltic, because these idiots in the NATO, they don't understand. Back the hell off. And Russia's not going to back down on this. And until this NATO issue is solved, a bunch of Ukrainians are going to continue to die. They're simply pawns of NATO. And here's Trump pretending, I don't have nothing to do with NATO. Nonsense.
Colonel, I have never thought that Donald Trump would be that much incapable of dealing with Zelensky. It seems that he's totally somehow not been able to put pressure on Zelensky the way that he was talking about it before.
No, it's Larry's right. This is a very dangerous game to play, and these Europeans have no idea how dangerous a game this is to play. We are responsible in many cases for putting them in place, as I've said other places. We've been working since 2002. I was there from 2 to 5 on getting governments elected in Europe that, one, do not represent their people, and two, represent our interests only. And we're paying for that now, paying for it dearly all across the enhanced membership in NATO. I think what Sergei Lavrov, Medinsky, Pavlov, others said in the last few hours, and the most operative phrase for them, is recognized by Trump. And that phrase is, got it written right here. We have to eliminate the basic, this is in English, eliminate the basic root causes of the conflict. How many times has Putin said that? How many times has Sergei Lavrov said that? How many times have any of the Russians said that? That's the real issue here. And you're not going to get any negotiations to succeed until you realize that's the issue based in Russia's existential fear of NATO being so proximate. It's got to cease. And Ukraine was the proxy for making that happen. And Ukraine has been defeated by blood and treasure of the Russians. And it needs to be recognized that we need to stop. Until we get to that point, until Trump gets to that point, and maybe he is at that point, he just doesn't know how to get it, operate into operation. We're not going to do anything. And Russia's going to keep on pushing and keep on winning. And keep on, the blood will keep on flowing. And ultimately, as Clausewitz tells us, the momentum of the war will be so incredible that Russia will have all of Ukraine, which it doesn't want, because it knows that it'd have an insurgency right off the bat, that it'd be hard to manage and so forth. So it doesn't want that. It wants it to stop. And now the press is full of this morning, these little innuendos about Putin being assassinated, about Putin losing his grip, about the Russian people wanting to get rid of Putin. This is all CIA shit. I wouldn't be surprised that Mossad isn't joining in it. And all the British and intelligence, MI6, you know, French intelligence and others. We need to stop this. We need to bring this conflict to a close. Trump said he would do it. Do it. Do it. And recognize that you have to see and deal with the root causes of this conflict. You and NATO, with Ukraine as your proxy.
What was Zelensky doing, Larry, in Istanbul? And he said that Putin is not here, he's not coming here to reach a deal. We know that it's so much, it's not that realistic. What was the main objective on his part?
Well, actually, he didn't go to Istanbul. He went to Ankara.
Ankara,
had a meeting with Erdogan. And, you know, they rubbed butter on each other's rear end. And then... he gave the blessing for his delegation led by Umarov to go to Istanbul. And then Zelensky flew to Albania to hang out at a NATO foreign ministers meeting. And, you know, there to, you know, suck up, you know, maybe they could have the cocaine cowboy party with, you know, Starmer and Macron. Maybe they come in, you know, and, hey, that was a great train ride. Let's do it again.
Albania is the place to do it.
yeah. I mean, it's a lot of the organized crime is there, and the cocaine flows freely. But you know, Zelensky's trying to posture this as if, you know, that I'm going to show up Putin. You know, Zelensky is a pimple on a gnat's ass is the reality. With respect to Putin. Putin is not obsessed with him. Putin recognizes correctly that Zelensky's just been a tool. He's been a willing conspirator with the West in their entire effort to try to destroy Russia. And I think he realizes, man, he's got to keep this gig going, because once it's over, he's a dead man, literally. Yeah. So... as long as they're still in the fight, you know, he can keep up the pretense. But, you know, I think Zelensky's days are numbered.
Colonel, do you understand the behavior of the new Chancellor of Germany, Merz?
Only in the fact that he was CEO of BlackRock, and I understand the CEOs of BlackRock. And he's got that kind of attitude. He's got that kind of corporate image attitude, that kind of, I can deal with anything. I can do it with Trump. I can do it with Macron. I can do it with anybody else in Europe. And oh, by the way, I can also do it with Germany. I don't even have the majority of the German people behind me, but I can do it with Germany because I'm powerful. I'm powerful. I think Merz is not long for this world as the Chancellor of Germany. I wouldn't give him 2025. Not much better. His foreign minister is a Nazi in many respects. You know, they talk about the AfD as being extreme and Nazi-like. This foreign minister is a former colonel or maybe even higher ranked than that in the Wehrmacht or in the German army. And he's got that kind of attitude that we ought to take on the Soviets again, and this time we ought to win, or the Russians. What a foreign minister.
Larry, is that putting AfD in a better position?
No. The problem... the European, not just Germany, the European political system is fractured. It's completely dysfunctional. There's no majority. I think Italy with Meloni is the closest they've come to a majority, and maybe Spain. Other than that, you know, you've got like in Germany, AfD, they said, oh man, they're moving up. They got 26% support. And then what, CDU's got 25%. So, you know, nobody's cracking the 50% level. So all you've guaranteed there is just a fragmented fistfight. And frankly, you know, I think that's where, you know, the United States is headed in that direction too. Yeah. Because you've got the fragmentation within the Democrat Party, and you've got it within the Republican Party as well, between the rhinos and the MAGA crowd and the neoconservative crowd. So when you start, once you've lost, let's call this political consensus about what national interests are truly important, then, you know, you've set yourself up for some real chaos. And so that's what I think Europe is going to be plagued with. That they're not going to be, you know, rallying around any one person. It'll be more like people in a lifeboat fighting over scraps of food, trying to stay alive themselves without regards to everybody else in the lifeboat.
And he left out Labour in England. I know he didn't mean to. They got lowest rating in the history of their party.
Yeah. I mean, the Labour and Conservative Party have basically now been surpassed, you know, I'll put quotations around that, by the, you know, sort of the Brexit party, Nigel Farage's party, except Farage's, again, he's not cracking above 30%. So, you know, this notion that, they're really shifted, you know, like Marie Le Pen's party, again, not a majority party in France. There is no one party that's a majority. There was a time when Labour could claim a majority status, or the CDU in Germany could claim a majority status, but, you know, those days are gone.
Colonel, given the complexity that Larry just was talking about, when it comes to Russia, when Putin looks at the way that Europe is today, and we know that at the end of the day, with a Ukrainian settlement, there has to be some sort of security architecture between Russia and Europe. And when they look at Europe today, I don't see that they can see any reasonable character in Europe to deal with. We have Orban and Fico, and somehow from the guy Vucic from Serbia, if I'm not mistaken, his name. And no one else is coming to my mind that would be capable of understanding what's going on and what's at risk for Europe if they separate from Russia. In a long run, they're going to lose a lot. That doesn't seem to be the case in the mind of the current European leaders.
No, I don't think so either. But my question is, because Larry's right, these leaders are going. In the next 12 to 24 months, they'll all be gone because they don't have the support of their people. And as they do things like you're suggesting they might do, or like Larry was describing they're doing up in the Baltic, they're going to lose the support of their people even more so. Difficult period to get through, though, to get to leaders that might feel differently and might represent a majority of their people, from Norway to Portugal and Spain. I think that's going to be an extremely difficult period, if not elongated into a 5-7 year period, to even imagine a new security architecture, not only one that would pull in Russia and encompass the whole area, but one that encompasses what we traditionally call Europe, or even Western Europe. It's going to be very difficult to do that. It's going to be a period fraught with danger, too, for the very reasons that were suggested, that people are still going to be trying to pick on Russia from the old crowd, as it were. And Putin's got to be very careful about that, and he's got to be very careful about how he responds to it. The response in the Baltic was pretty good, I think. And those kind of responses need to keep happening without deleterious results. It's going to be a tough period. This is a period where Europe is fractured and falling apart. And we are partially responsible. And we're not doing anything right now to help them arrest that tendency and to start on a new path. I don't know if Trump's capable of that. I don't know if this government is capable of that, but it is a future problem. And throw that into what I said about the inexorable movement of power away from the West and toward the East. That includes Europe. And that's going to be an unconscionable position for a lot of leaders to take in any way to recognize and deal with. But that's what they should be doing. It's a multinodal world now. It's a world where there are a lot of near peer powers or peer powers, if you will. It's a world that is going to be increasingly dominated by the Chinese and to a certain extent their alliances, as it were, and not us. And we've got to accept that, and we've got to deal with it. And we've got to deal with it with diplomacy and with economic power and cultural power and informational power and intelligence, all of it, not the military and not sanctions. We have to deal with it in an entirely different way. I love the expression that Xi Jinping uses from time to time. It's an ASEAN community type world. It's an ASEAN community type world. I had to work with ASEAN for a long time trying to bring about a policy of their having some kind of security component. We were ramming it down their throat. You got to have a security. And their response was, no, we do not want a security component. That gets you in trouble. We are for finance. We're for informational exchange. We're for artistic and cultural exchange. We're for all manner of soft power, but we aren't for hard power. Thank you very much. We do not want to be a member of NATO East. That's what we're talking about now, I think. And we've got to deal with that. If we're not willing to deal with that, we're going to be a pariah of the world. And the rest of the world, four-fifths of which is not us, is going to move on.
Larry, it seems that the problem that Europe has with Russia is not just the case of Ukraine. They're using Ukraine to somehow behave the way that we're witnessing right now. But it seems to me that in the mind of Europeans, the problem is Russia. It's not Ukraine. And how do you see, because if you look at Ukraine today, Ukraine's army today is in coma. And they're talking about the guy that is in coma is going to play in the national team. That's not possible unless you have other agendas behind what you're talking about.
Well, again, this is, like I said, this has been a more than 30, 35-year project, going back with the foundation of when the Soviet Union broke up and then all these former Soviet states emerged. The United States could have made the choice, along with the Europeans, to let's embrace Russia. Because Russia was saying it all along, hey, look, well, let us join NATO. Yeltsin made the request, Putin made the request, and they were turned down. And they were turned down for one very simple reason. The military-industrial complex that they own Washington about to the same extent that AIPAC does, insisted that we had to have an expansion of NATO, because if you expand NATO, then you get all these new NATO countries that have to buy all this new U.S. equipment and buy from these U.S. corporations whose bottom line depends upon expanding economic growth through government, the government giving them money. So this desire, this plan to provoke Russia was in place, and it really started under Clinton in 1999. I think we talked about it last week where, in March 12th of 99, Clinton adds three countries, Poland, Romania, and the Czech Republic to NATO. 2 weeks later, the United States starts attacking Serbia, bombing, which was a Russian ally. Then on August 7th, U.S. supplied, funded, Chechen insurgents who are tied to ISIS launch an attack into Dagestan, which starts a 10-year Chechen war. This was all done designed to stabilize Russia, and that's when Putin took over. And Putin, smart guy, he recognized Russia at the time was militarily and economically not prepared to confront the United States and Europe. He started trying to rebuild and reform. The reforms didn't really start kicking in until 2008, after Western-backed forces launched the attacks on Russian positions in Ossetia and Abkhazia in Georgia. And remember, there have been Russian peacekeepers there since 1991, when those two areas in Georgia wanted to break away and declare their own independence. and Russia had sent peacekeepers that had been there for, you know, well over 15 years. And so all of this was coming against the backdrop of the United States and NATO wanting to expand NATO and the Europeans going along with it. And Putin saying, no. And they finally they did it. You know, George Bush added seven countries in 2004. Barack added one or two. Trump added one. Biden added three. Now it's up to 32. And that's where this root cause is entirely part of NATO. And yet, despite Biden's claims that NATO is more unified than it's ever been, it's coming apart at the seams.
Absolutely.
Because there is no unity within. But that's where the problem lies. And frankly, eliminate NATO, a lot of these problems go away.
Nima, you ever heard about the great man theory of history? Let me give you an example. If Colin Powell had decided in 1995 to run, and both parties were after him, both parties, hadn't happened since Eisenhower, if he decided to run, he would have won. Had he been president, the world would be a different place. That's how bad Bill Clinton was to kick all this off that Larry just described.
Yeah.
I'll never forgive him for it. I'll never forgive him for it.
What Larry just said, Carl, shows that how delusional is the mindset of Europeans. And we have to consider that those days are gone. They're not there anymore. Russia today is a totally different country in terms of their military, their economy, the ties that they have been growing stronger with China, Iran, and even India, I would argue, within the BRICS. And you see the same strategy on the part of Europeans, as Larry was just pointing out. How do you see Europeans confronting the reality? Is there any place for reality in their mind?
Not very well. Not very well. And look at what just happened, apparently, and I'm glad it happened, with India and Pakistan. They reconciled their differences. They exchanged a few rounds of one another and reconciled their differences. I'm sure that the good offices of Beijing and the good offices of Moscow had much to do with that. Although I'm told we finally did weigh in, I'm not told how effective our weigh-in was. And I doubt it was very effective. I suspect the others did the heavy lifting. Inexorable power has got to be recognized sooner or later. Those who don't recognize it are going to rue the day they didn't, and maybe even the moment they didn't, like, for example, the incident in the Baltic. It's inevitable. It's inexorable. It's happening. And if Europe can't accept it and the United States won't accept it, we're in trouble. We're in big trouble because, like I said before, we are one-fifth of the world. Less than that, really, if you factor out Russia from Europe. That's about 148 million people that don't count anymore. So, you know, the world's changing, it's shifting, and if you don't accommodate it, you are going to be left out in the cold.
Larry, does Donald Trump need or Putin need to meet with Donald Trump or Putin? And these two characters, these two leaders, do you find that they do need to meet?
Putin doesn't need to meet with him, but Trump does need that meeting. If nothing else, just to solidify his, own his reputation, believing that he's the greatest deal maker in the world. when they meet, Putin's going to be polite and direct, and will again explain to Donald Trump why, you know, what Russia's bottom line is. These NATO provocations have got to stop. And Trump, you know, right now the NATO plans are to, and the U.S. plans are to build this enormous base in Romania. It'll be the largest military base, the U.S. military base in Europe. Well, there's no need for that. Stop. Back away. Take out the Arrow missile systems or the Aegis missile systems that are on the grounds in Poland and Romania, pointed at Russia. There's no reason for that. A meeting like that would be valuable if it would persuade Trump to stop the madness. But, you know, Trump still labors under the delusion that he had nothing to do with this conflict, and that, you know, what happened between Russia and Ukraine had nothing to do with him, despite the fact that when he was, you know, during his first term, the NATO military exercises became more aggressive, more oriented towards offensive action, up to and including when, you know, he authorized the B-52 bombers were allowed to fly along Crimea, this coast, during a, quote, exercise. And he sent javelin, brags about, I sent them those javelins. I didn't send blankets like Obama. Well, you should be really proud of that. So, you know, he's part of the problem. He's refused to accept that. And, you know, hopefully Vladimir Putin will gently remind him of that.
And he's got Hegseth as his Secretary of Defense, and he's got Vance as his Vice President. And both of these people, Hegseth, because he can be talked into it, I think, and Vance, because he believes it, are amenable to doing things more sanely. And I heard yesterday that the only way anything is ever going to happen, if it happens positively with regard to Ukraine, is if Trump and Putin meet. All these intermediaries are, you know, just fluff. Trump and Putin have to meet. I think that's true. But it's only true if Trump is on his game, if Trump is, you know, wanting to do what he said he wanted to do, which is to shut the war down, and is willing to listen to what the real reasons for the war are. As was said so many times, basic root cause of the conflict. I don't know what the Russian is for that, but the basic root cause of the conflict. And what Larry just described is part of that basic root cause of the conflict. So when they talk, they've got to talk about all these things. And Trump's got to understand that what I think Vance wants to do is what he should do, and they should do as an administration. And that's to shut down a lot of what is planned for Europe that would be unconscionable for Russia to accept, existential for Russia to accept, and deal with that. They've got to deal with that. It's not just Ukraine. It's all the trappings thereof and all the trappings of NATO.
And Donald Trump has a good memory of that, Larry, if you remember, in terms of Russiagate, when he talked with Putin, he said that, no, we didn't do anything. And Donald Trump said that he's going to accept what Putin is doing over what CIA was suggesting to him.
Go back. Part of the reason the entire Russiagate thing was hatched is because they recognized that Trump posed a genuine existential threat to this corrupt system that is predicated upon portraying Russia as the enemy. And the last thing they want is to, once Russia is no longer out there as an enemy, we can no longer use it as a tool to try to destroy China. I mean, there's some really evil, nefarious people in this. And they're in the intelligence community, they're in the policy community at state, they're in the Defense Department establishment. They sort of agreed to the general approach, and you got to have Russia as an enemy, and to that extent, anytime you can impugn Trump's motives, his character, that any effort to try to deal fair and reasonably with Russia is going to be couched as, oh, he's just a puppet of Putin.
Carl, do you have something to add?
No, I was just going to say a lot of the people who are opposed to Trump and opposed to what Trump wants to do, if we're interpreting him properly, are people who have weaponized liberal democracy the way the Spanish and others, but the Spanish come to mind immediately with Cortez and Pizarro, weaponized Christianity. They were really colonialists. The most reprehensible of colonialists. And they wanted the money. They didn't have anything to do with Christianity, really, although some of them did. But a lot of these people in the bureaucracy, they're like the real Christians were then. They do think liberal democracy needs to be spread to the whole world. That's the reason Trump's remarks were so remarkable in the Middle East, because he repudiated all that. Liberal democracy, Christianity, take your pick, is not what we should be doing diplomacy with. But these people believe that. They believe it in their hearts. And so you got to root all that out too.
Thank you so much, Larry and Colonel Wilkerson. Great pleasure as always.
Great way to end the week.
Thanks great for having me.
Thank you.
Look after Brazil now. I just got a paper from a guy who's got a new economic solution for Buenos Aires. And it reads beautifully. And I told him, I said, how are you going to get this adopted? He said, that's the key. Yeah, because it doesn't involve all the rapine and all the IMF loans that get called in later and bankrupt you and, you know, dealing with the 5%. It involves actually making Argentina the kind of bustling, successful economy it should be. Good luck.
Yeah.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Bye.